Our next speaker is Dr. Jason Eberhard Phillips. Until recently, Jason Eberhard Phillips was a health officer of El Dorado County, California. He is now, quite recently, I think only a month ago or so, as director of the health and state health officer in Kansas. He will be talking today about a school-based immunization program for preteens he helped launch in his county in California called Immunization Extreme. Please welcome Dr. Phillips.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It is such a delight to have been invited to speak to you about this. Although I'm no longer the health officer in El Dorado County, I'm really proud of what has been achieved there for adolescent health through this school-based immunization program that we call IZ Extreme. Just a little bit about El Dorado County first. It's shown there on the California map. It's home to about 176,000 people. It's located in the Sierra Nevada foothills and going up east of Sacramento, over Echo Summit, and down into South Lake Tahoe. Unlike many other parts of California, our population in El Dorado County is largely white and non-Hispanic. It's relatively well-educated. There aren't extremes of wealth and poverty, so that in the median, we're relatively high in terms of income for California, fourth highest in the state. More than 95% of our children attend the 14 public school districts that we have, those school districts having 16 middle schools or schools with middle school-aged children. Now, as everyone in this room knows, there have been some really fantastic breakthroughs in vaccines aimed at preteens in recent years. You know what they are: meningococcal disease, the Tdap vaccine, the HPV vaccine, and of course now we have the easier delivery, more acceptable for many people, of intranasal spray flu vaccine available for healthy people aged 2 to 49. And like other public health agencies around the country, we in El Dorado County have been strongly urging parents to take advantage of these dramatic opportunities and get their kids to their health care providers to obtain these vaccines. But we know that kids in this age group very rarely seek medical care, and the care that they get is usually quite episodic and is focused on acute problems. Parents of kids in this age group have lots of barriers to getting their kids immunized, not just the high cost of the vaccines and the medical visits, but the time and trouble involved in taking kids out of school and traveling. And we're finding in our county, like in many parts of America, more and more providers are unwilling to even provide immunization in their medical homes. So we asked ourselves back in 2007, is there a better way? And we decided yes. Why don't we look at a school-based immunization program? We know that such programs, going way back to the days of the first polio vaccine, have a long history of effectiveness. It gives us an opportunity to reach some of the hard-to-reach kids who may not have good access to medical care because we still have a public education system that's universal in this country. It's obviously convenient for parents because they're not even directly involved in having to get the kids to the service. And as we convinced each one of the school boards for these districts when we presented the idea, immunizing, as you would well agree, is complementary to their overall mission to have a healthy student body. And we realized that doing this kind of work was really going to be a highly visible thing, which is good for public health. So our idea, our big, hairy, audacious idea, was to offer the recommended preteen vaccines to every sixth and seventh grader who is lucky enough to live in El Dorado County. And to provide those vaccinations, we were really strict about this, in school during regular school hours, and we'd give them away at no cost to parents. So how did this work? We got a packet of information that went out to all the parents in the beginning of September. And that packet would include things you would expect, the VISs. We had two pages of FAQs. We had a very simple, easy to fill out medical history form and a really simple consent form with the menu of vaccines that you just check off the ones you wanted. We provided this in both English and for those who required it, Spanish. We stressed that the program's completely voluntary. Parents could elect to have some, all, or none of the vaccines that we were offering. Of course, no child would receive the vaccines without signed consent forms. And we had a public health nurse assigned to each school who would individually review each one of the forms and medical histories that came in. So starting in 2007, in early October, our teams of public health staff and community volunteers paid a visit at a regularly scheduled time to each of the 16 middle schools. We don't have a nice fancy RV. This is California. We just had a couple of beat up old vans, but we got there. And we would take the kids out of class in groups. We promised the schools a 30-minute turnaround max. And they'd go to a specified room where they would go through the whole process with our specially trained staff. And we would return to the school in December and April so that we could complete the HPV series. This slide gives you kind of just an overview. Each school is different, but the kids would come in at the bottom of the slide there. They'd have their paperwork checked over. They'd sit in a waiting area. Then there'd be this visibility barrier between them and the immunizers. And then after they were done, they'd go out up at the upper right after getting their snacks and parting gift. So the first year results from 2007-08, that's kind of some pictures of what it looked like. We could basically go into a school and be all set up in 15 minutes once we got good at it. We began with a community-wide publicity campaign. I have a op-ed kind of column in the local newspapers. We used that. We went on TV. We used local magazines. We used school newsletters. We used presentations at back-to-school nights. We used the reverse 911 that many of the districts have to kind of bother people at their dinner hour. We used the school marquees, anything we could do, and we sent out about 5,000 of these packets for what we determined was about 4,927 eligible kids, and we got 42% of those back. The response rates varied between about 66% and 31%, and factors favoring a high response included a school nurse or principal who was a real champion of the program. Also, it was higher where parents were involved and where local medical providers were especially supportive. Now, of those who responded, 383 actually turned us down, but most of them indicated, we were grateful to see this, that the child was either already vaccinated or would be getting the vaccines elsewhere, and that was okay with us. So we had about 1,665 kids. Of those, almost all of them got immunized that first October. A few got vouchers to use at our clinic, but actually we picked them up when we came back in December. And I'm happy to say that for that first year, and again, knocking on wood, we had no significant adverse reactions. So of those kids, just so you know, about 85% got the meningococcal vaccine, 73% opted for the Tdap. We got 76% of the girls immunized against HPV, and 83% got one of the two flu vaccines. Typically, a child would be getting three or four vaccines, and you know, for 11 and 12-year-olds, that was quite a lot to handle. But they got professional care from start to finish. They would be greeted by our paperwork checkers. They'd verify that. They'd confirm the vaccine choices. We found out a lot of the kids were not told by their parents that they were going to be having this. And some of them were a little anxious about that. And if they needed a fast track and kind of cut off the waiting period to receive some very compassionate care, that's what we did. And we helped anyone who was having difficulty deal with the stress of the multiple injections. The whole procedure was either seen by a physician or a physician's assistant wherever we went. What the kids got was drinks and cookies during their 15-minute kind of waiting period afterwards. They got this really cool, flexible flyer, which has our logo on it. They just really loved these. Certified lead-free. In California, we have to do that. Parents got this yellow card showing which vaccines were given, and of course, they got enrolled in the local regional immunization registry. This is a particularly handsome seventh grader. It's my son, Paul, who's absolutely delighted that he only was getting the intranasal flu vaccine because he was already covered for the other vaccines. We followed up with this by returning to the schools, as I said, for the second and third doses of HPV. Yeah, unlike in medical practices, we could almost guarantee a 100% completion of the full series because we know where these girls are, and we go back and we finish it for them. And our goal has always been to return every October and do the incoming sixth grade class such that over a number of years we'll develop an immune cohort of adolescents and young adults living in our county. Just briefly, in the second year, working with these sixth graders, out of about 2,100, we got a slightly better response back from the parents, almost 50%, but actually fewer kids proportionally who we were able to immunize. We're just next month going to be finishing up the HPV vaccine. We've got a new program in 2008. We call it Kung Flu Fighters. This is a school-based immunization program for elementary age kids using the same IZ Extreme concept. Again, providing the vaccine in schools during school hours at no cost to parents. Those not getting the FluMist, of course, get the TIV. We were invited into our largest and most disadvantaged district in South Lake Tahoe this year to undertake this as a pilot project. Just looking at the first year results for that, about 1,700 elementary age kids invited to participate. We got 43% of them immunized, almost all with the FluMist. We were grateful to see that our coverage was highest in our most socially disadvantaged school, lowest in the most advantaged school. Most of the kids had never been immunized against the flu before. That's why 59% required the second dose. We saw that this was, compared to giving four jabs to an 11-year-old, this was so easy. We got it down to less than 20 seconds a kid. So how are we doing? Well, the program is a clear-cut success for the kids who participate. In 2 years, we've given more than 8,000 vaccines at no cost, at great convenience, and in a professional way. Obviously, for non-participants, they get much less out of it besides some herd immunity, perhaps. The real issue is this parental response to our invitation. How can we do that? I mean, I lost a lot of sleep thinking about this. Is there any other way we could publicize this? What do I have to do to give away $500-something dollars worth of vaccine in this county? I mean, I don't know what I need to do. Do we get more medical buy-in? It was already pretty good for the medical community. Are there more creative approaches to getting those consent forms back? Is there a larger role for classroom teachers? So we got some really good response rates from teachers who championed the program and gave their students extra credit for just turning in their consent form. We do more of that. Do we need to have a more direct and active response against the small but potentially growing anti-vaccine lobby in our county? Sometimes I ask, well, why do we bother doing all this? Well, we obviously want to maximize the benefits of the available VFC vaccines. It's great training for our staff for mass vaccination events. It's done a lot to raise the profile of public health in our county. Many people in our county don't know us in public health for doing anything else. And it's really strengthened our partnerships with schools so that we could probably do a lot of other creative things with them on the strength of our success here. But ultimately, we do this because we live in the community and we want to live where there's a high level of immunity against these diseases. And we really didn't see it happening any other way. This was the result of the hard work of just countless people, only a few of whom can make it onto this slide, and I want to acknowledge them. And if anyone wants any additional information, I don't know why, but if you do, you can go to this website, and we have a very detailed report showing exactly how we did this there. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, everybody. We're open for questions to any of the panelists. Melinda?
I think it's okay, it's on now. Thank you, those were great presentations. One of the things that I always wonder about in doing these school-based clinics is to what degree there's an issue to manage with the line of sight response to the vaccination process. And I know this was addressed in one of the presentations, but thinking about prevention of syncope or other responses that in fact might be influenced by being vaccinated in the presence of so many peers. Could y'all address that?
Well, we had those visibility barriers, and so we created like little booths where the kids were, not visible to their peers. Not those waiting and not those in recovery. And we felt because of the issue you raised and the potential for mass hysteria, whatever you call it, that would be the most prudent way to go. We had someone's grandmother who was willing to sew all those things for us, and we put it onto plastic PVC piping, which was really easy after we learned how to do it, to take it up and put it down again. And that's what we continue to use, and it's cheap and easy.
Thanks.
My first question is, who actually administered the vaccines? Were these the school nurses? Did you use public health nurses? Or are yours the states where MAs are able to give them? So I guess I want to know from all three of you who you used, because personnel is a big problem for me.
Well, this went over like a two-week period in the first 2 weeks of October. So we pulled nursing staff that we had from all various different programs to be actually doing the injecting and the preparation and mixing up of the vaccines. We also had a couple of retired nurses who were available to us, but we made certain that they were all public health nurses or recently retired.
That's great to hear. So it didn't impact on your flu vaccine program, because our flu vaccine program runs at the same time of the year, from like October through November.
Well, we got it over just before we
okay,
got it.
Okay, so you hit this first and then you went
right
for the flu. Okay,
that's we literally had this program going in 2007, the day after the first flu miss touched ground in California. Like on the 1st of October, we were doing this, and we were rushing to get it done before we went on with the traditional flu clinics.
Thank you. And for Valerie, was it public health nurses for you also?
Yes, yeah, all of our public health nurses from our local health department are the ones that administer the vaccines, but we do utilize a lot of volunteers to help with other things like getting kids to and from the school building, back into the school building. We have a list of volunteers that we utilize for that, but as far as administering the vaccines, all of our public health nurses pretty much clear their schedule for that day or, you know, a couple days during the week when we go out a week at a time, and that's what we do.
Thank you. My other question is for Stephen. You mentioned about getting the buy-in from the community, from the physicians in the community. In our community, I think if the doctors could pay us to hire more public health nurses, they would, to go into the schools, because they've clearly indicated to us that they just don't have the capacity to help the schools or even to have that many children coming to their practices now that we're vaccinating all of the adolescents. And in my I'm from Suffolk County in New York, and our population is 1.4 million people. And I have the schools lined up. I just need them to give me money to hire the nurse to help me out, because that's the finances are having such a big impact on our staff right now. So could you address that, please?
I guess she's asking if it's really the buy-in from the medical community, because she's saying the medical community would really welcome this because they don't have the capacity. Maybe you're talking more about younger, or, you know.
Because you were mentioning, like, the medical home. And like our docs were saying, the medical home's a wonderful thing, but they just don't have the capacity to handle vaccinating all these adolescents, especially for flu vaccine. So they're really pushing the health department in our neck of the woods to come in and to do it. If they could, they would hire the public health nurses themselves to go and do it for them.
Yeah, in other words, you're saying that the practitioners there are overwhelmed?
They are overwhelmed, and they're looking for the support from us.
Right, and almost universally, when you have those set of circumstances, either that the practitioners are overwhelmed just with the volume, or that there's so many financial constraints placed on them, you know, doing a joint program between public health and the private practicing community to take the take on a school immunization, I think, is the ideal circumstance. I mean, I suspect that your local county medical society, you know, would fully embrace any kind of a suggestion to try and get this accomplished. The thing that's a little bit interesting here is in higher population concentrations where you have more PCPs, you know, in rural areas I think it's easier to do this, but in urban areas they're a bit more competitive, and I think they're fearful. Some of those people are fearful that those people won't come in for their health checkups because they've gotten their immunizations in schools. If you get together with the local medical society, you can easily dispel that, I think.
Oh, we have. It's gone.
Yeah,
they
great.
Just, but we have over 300 practicing pediatricians in my county. And
great.
But the bottom line is, the health department doesn't have enough staff to send in. We've already done that, so.
Well, I would pose to you, I'd go back to them and say, look, we need to come up with a plan as to how we're going to staff this, and we're having a hard time and you're having a hard time, but how are we going to do it?
That's a very good suggestion. Thank you very much.
I would go back to them with that, because you both really need, you don't need an epidemic on your hand in your community.
No, we don't. And generally speaking, we're not doing a very good job of vaccinating adolescents. Thank you very much.
So I wanted to ask Jason, and thank you all very much. It was a wonderful presentation by each of you. I wanted to ask Jason about your forms that went out to parents. I was wondering if you had thought about giving the forms with an opportunity to decline and state the reason for declination, and then therefore you could ask all the students to return and provide some kind of peer pressure or individual incentive to return a form, whether the parent declined or not. That way you could actually know, first of all, which percentage of the parents are actively declining versus the parents never having seen the form. and also maybe the reason as to why they declined. And then I have a second really quick question also for you. I was wondering about the physicians and whether you, why you needed physician and or PA presence. So I'll take it offline. Thank you.
Yeah, well, if I understand your question right, we did ask them the reason why they declined, and that's how we knew that the vast majority in the first year when we did the analysis did it because they at least had the perception that they were already immunized or were going to be doing it anyway. But when people don't return the form at all, and when we, you know, just anecdotally, randomly talked to different parents about that, who said they didn't even know anything about it, we started wondering how much more can we beat the drum about this. The second year, we sent it home through the schools. The first year, it was actually through the U.S. Postal Service at $1.41 for each one, plus the 41-cent return envelope, which was provided inside. And we lost, you know, thousands of dollars not getting a response from those non-responders. Amazingly, parents who were like on the school grounds on the day that they see us coming come rushing up to us saying, how can I get my kid in this? You know, well, you're after the deadline, but here's the form you need and we'll do it right now. So. Well, we didn't feel it was essential, but a couple of lawyers for a couple of districts did. And they also wanted a bunch of disclaimers put on our form. They didn't tell us how small we could make that type, so we made it real small.
I have a question for Valerie and for Jason. Valerie, first of all, did you do multi vaccine clinics, or did you only do one vaccine at a time? And then for each of you, if you could comment on the ease and the challenges of doing a one vaccine clinic versus multiple vaccine clinics.
We actually offer all of the vaccines for each clinic that we go to, and that's why it's really important to keep, you know, it's in a separate location with a separate label. And then we also have, you know, what we call table paper that we put down on the desk where we're giving the vaccinations, and each nurse will write down, you know, each vaccine, the lot number and the manufacturer right there, and then that's where they keep that individual vaccine. That's how they kind of keep them separated. And then as well as we write it on the whiteboard to keep the different lot numbers and vaccines separated. But that seems to work really well when, you know, each nurse places the vaccine where they have it written. They know which vaccine they're giving where.
Right. We had, you know, similar systems that I wasn't really involved in developing, but that I was assured would make it easy, and it sure appeared to be that way. Just doing the flu, particularly with the flu mist in the elementary ages, as I indicated in the talk, was amazingly easy. We could burn through all the kids we were going to do, which was up to half of the kids in an elementary school, in an hour and a half, 2 hours, and that would be the whole thing. So I'm really excited about seeing more school-based flu immunization next season, because I think it's really within reach.
I share that excitement. So I'd like to know the processes in California and Wyoming, how you got VFC vaccine to be used for all of this, particularly in California, where you described the economy as being somewhat robust.
In Wyoming, we order our vaccine through our state immunization program. They're the ones that provide all of our vaccine for children. We are a universal state, so therefore we're able to offer that to all children, you know, ages birth through 18. So we just order it through our state program, and they're the ones that provide it to our office.
As I understand it, California isn't a universal state, but there is a loophole which we drive a truck through. to get a combination of 317 and state funding to purchase vaccines for local health departments to use, which makes the vaccine available to everyone meeting age criteria regardless of their source of payment. So by exploiting that loophole, because it was coming through us, we could do this. And we were, you know, really pleased that we could do that and that we had the support of the immunization program in pursuing that.
Hi, thank you so much. These were great presentations. As a veteran of school immunization programs, to get those forms back, you give a $25 gift certificate to the teachers that get all their forms back. That's how you get it. I've given pizza party to classrooms that doesn't do it. You give a $25 gift certificate to every teacher that gets all her forms back, and you'll get them all back to Target for their educational materials. I have a question about your menu where you sent the information home to the parents, and then they were allowed to choose a menu of vaccines of which one they wanted.
Yeah.
How did you deal with catch-up vaccines? So if you had somebody who still needed a dose of hepatitis B, but the parent hadn't indicated that they wanted a hepatitis B vaccine, maybe because they didn't even know the kid needed it, how did you deal with that?
I'm sorry if I didn't make it clear. We limited the scope of the program to the preteen vaccines that have, you know, newly been recommended, so that we weren't there to catch up people
on catch up
vaccines that they hopefully should have had earlier in childhood.
Okay, thank you.
Here's one.
Hi, I'm Jim from Indiana, and my question is again about financing. So if in our state, if we use BFC vaccine or 317 or state funded, we still need to determine eligibility for those children so that we know where to pull that vaccine from. How did you do that?
Well, that isn't a requirement when it's the local health department that's providing the vaccine. And to be honest with you, you know, we were going to follow the law, but that really, that kind of eligibility checking is something that flies in the face of providing a service for which an entire community benefits. And we would be prepared to fight that to the extent that we could anyway. But we didn't have to fight it. It was universal because it was coming through us.
Philosophically, I agree with you. Does the CDC agree with that?
Ask them.
Okay. Anyone willing to comment on that? Because we have this issue in Indiana also.
Well, it's just a reason not to do it.
I am no expert, but it's my understanding, because I'm from the state of Florida, I'm Chuck Alexander, and we do the same thing in our county health departments. We provide VFC and 317 funding, so all children who walk through the health department door can receive immunizations. However, I think that CDC, my understanding is that we still have to determine eligibility for those patients just for tracking purposes and funding purposes.
I thought, Abby, you might try answering based on these pilots that have been done. I mean, CDC's been supporting some pilot activities with influenza vaccination associated with schools where ability to figure out the billing or the source of payment was sort of a criteria. In general, VFC is for VFC eligible children, not for everybody else. But as we heard, the 317 and state funds can pay for everybody else. But what's actually happening in the ground, I really am learning as I listen to you.
Yeah, I mean, if I understand correctly, and I'm not an expert on this, is that it's okay to use, obviously VFC vaccine is only for VFC eligible children, but you can supplement with 317 funds. And you know, some of the pilots we're actually doing now is to see third party billing, so kids that have insurance, private insurance that covers vaccines, that they can, whoever gives the vaccines at the school, they actually bill. So maybe there could be more discussion afterwards, because it's complicated, but that's my understanding. Let's just have one more question.
I'm from South Bend, Indiana. We did a pilot project this year with the flu mist, and we were able to get the vaccine so we could immunize any of those kids through the state by working with the schools that were designated as Title I schools. So those schools had almost 50% of their students that were on free and reduced lunches. And so we were able, with it being a pilot program for us, we immunized about 1,700 children with the flu mist, and hope to expand the program this fall with the Manactra and Tdap. And there's been a lot of requests from two of the school districts say, please do this. One of the key factors that we found in staff availability, all of my public health nurses were willing to do the flu mist, and it does go very quickly. But we also took advantage of, staffing issues are always a concern, but we have the advantage of having schools of nursing in South Bend, and we have students that rotate through our health department. So we utilize school nurses. Even with doing some of the education to watch the kids for a few minutes after the flu mist administration. The other thing that was very key in getting the word out was the school nurse in each of those schools, the buy-in from the school principal to get word to her teachers and encourage the teachers to get those forms back and talk to their students. And you could tell by whichever school we were in, which teachers and which schools had really made it a priority on their list, because some classes we would only have maybe 4 or 5 kids that were getting the flu mist, and some classes we might have 22 kids out of 24. And I think that's a reflection of the leadership in the school and the commitment to making it a priority, and it makes a big difference.
Thank you very much. So this was a great session. Thank you very much for the speakers.
Housekeeping announcements.